The following program contains views and opinions that do not necessarily reflect those of KMRE staff or of the Spark Museum of Electrical Invention.
It's Cascadia News Now. I am Stephanie Contouris with my co-host Dave Willingham and Cascadia Weekly's Tim Johnson. Tonight, we have two very special guest hosts in the studio, Michael Vindiola and Smakia. And I am going to let you both introduce yourselves, if that's okay.
Welcome, friends and relatives, each and every one of you. And what an honor it is to be here today. My name is Michael Vindiola. I'm a Swinomish Indian Tribal Community member. And I also work as the director of the Office of Native Education under the Office of the Superintendent of Public Instruction for the state of Washington, K through 12. And I'm here to talk about Indian education and very excited to do that.
Now, Siam Smakia Tanasnat, Chokalamisan. Hello, my dear friends and relatives. My name is Smakia, and I'm from Lummi. I'm a Lummi language teacher at Ferndale High School, also at Horizon Middle School, and also teach Lummi language for our community.
And how long have you been teaching?
So for the school district, I've been teaching since 2001. That's about 15 years. For Horizon Middle School, this is my third year, so it's been great.
Well, welcome to both of you. We have so many questions and a lot to talk about tonight, but Smakia, I'd like to talk about something that people can't see, and that is your shirt that says OCM, and I'm not going to pronounce what it says underneath it, but would you tell me about that?
So this is kind of like, I don't know how you would say that. It has the letters O, has the letter C, has the letter M. So in Lummi language, when we say OCM, it's about an understanding. It's also, you know, talking about people of respect. So at the bottom, it says Nisjala Chisiam. OCM Nisjala Chisiam, my respected friends and relatives. And so knowing Lummi language and also playing on the English, you know, just the simple letters, you know, it's kind of I guess you would call it a pun.
I was going to say it's not normally spelled that way.
No. But when you look at it, it's like you can say it because it says O-C-M. Yeah,
it's beautiful.
You know, on several occasions, I've had the honor of and pleasure of sitting in the living room of the hereditary chief of Lummi Nation, Chief Bill James, and he one time shared with me just how close it came to the Lummi language becoming an extinct language, where there were only maybe three or four people that could actually speak it, and they got together, and this language will live. And they taught it to their children and to their grandchildren. And I've actually seen him teach his children and grandchildren in his living room.
Yep.
And I wonder if you can validate that comment of his that we became very close to losing the Lummi language.
Very close. Bill was my teacher. Not only so, like, it started back in high school. When I was in high school, we had class for 30 minutes at a time, and he would come in and share a few words. And, you know, back then I could pick it up, but I still wasn't interested. And then wasn't until, you know, actually being involved with the Lummi Records and Archives, I was doing a summer internship, and, you know, they told me that LIBC allows the employees 30 minutes a day to go and learn their language. And so that's where, you know, I made that transition. And I went over, and I took the time, and, you know, it started off with just a few words. And then after the internship was done, I never really followed through. But I ended up working for the community doing repatriation work. And the same thing was every morning, all of us that was a part of that crew, there must have been about maybe 10 of us, but we were required to learn Lummi language. So my cousin and I, we always sat next to each other, and we kind of made it a competition. Mm-hmm. Between the two of us, we would see who could remember the most. And, you know, this is what Bill had saw when, you know, he was kind of testing to see who had the memory, who could pick it up, who could speak it, say the words. And so when that funding began to run out, the Bill had come to talk to us, and he says, I want you to apply. I have these positions coming up, and I want you to apply. And he picked like two or three of us out of the whole crew, and you know, asked if we would apply for these jobs that were coming up. And it wasn't like a regular office job. It was more of a research job. And so it was really neat. When we did get hired on, it wasn't just sitting in the office and having a class every day. It was about going out into our surroundings, gathering different things, and talking about all the language that went with that. And so I think that had a great impact on my life. And, you know, during the summer times, I actually get to do that with all of my students that I have. So it's really, really an awesome thing to learn firsthand.
Well, you had mentioned repatriation work, and I wondered if you could just expand on that a little bit, what that work involved and why that was, and why the Lummi language was critical to that repatriation.
So the repatriation work was, let's see, what year was that? Must have been 1998, 1999. The Blaine sewer treatment plant was getting ready to expand on their facilities. And back in the 70s, when they built their water sewer treatment plant, they had discovered human remains, and those were our ancestors. And so they had previously known that there was remains in this area. And so when it came time for them to expand, you know, it's the same spot, but it was like years later, and people had forgotten that this was an ancient burial site. And so when they tried to expand, they dug up remains, and it was a huge, huge, you know, I guess you could call it a cemetery. You know, we never really called it a cemetery back then, but we just knew that as our burial grounds. And so somewhere along the way, when people are doing excavation, bringing all of this stuff that they're excavating to different sites to use as landfill, somewhere along the way, somebody had spotted, oh, there's human remains in that. And so it kind of sparked the question, is like, where did you get this from? And so we had found out that, you know, the city of Blaine wanted to expand their water and sewer treatment plant, and found out that, you know, they're basically, they went through their permitting process, which goes through the city of Blaine. But since there was, it was an ancient burial ground, that, you know, they really needed to actually halt and wait for permission from the local tribe, which would be Lummi. And so that part never really happened. They had hired, I forget who it was, but there was somebody to come in and check and see if it was humans, human remains, animal remains, or whatever it was. And these people actually sent stuff off to Denver, and it was, you know, just really crazy that, you know, they thought to do this. Why not just ask the local tribe? And why not just, you know, admit that they made a mistake? And of course, nobody wants to admit that. So they continued and continued, and we found out that there were several different sites where they actually brought the remains, brought the materials to use as landfill. And so once we found out, you know, there was a team of us that was hired to go and excavate and gather as much of the remains as we could, keep them intact as possible. And then, you know, basically set them aside and then continue. And this took years. It's not even, I don't even think that everything is completely finished being cataloged. It was just a huge, huge excavation that they did. And, you know, I don't know how many of our ancestors that they actually dug up, but, you know, it's very sad. So one of the requirements was that, you know, we learn Lummi language. And while we're doing this work, you know, we have to keep a good mind, we have to keep a strong mind. And by learning our language as we're doing this work, you know, helped us build our mind so that we're not thinking bad thoughts, we're not, you know, thinking crazy thoughts. And, you know, Lummi language, there's so much to it. We could say one thing and it could have 10 different meanings, or, you know, there's so many different meanings in the world, and we could just say one word and it says all that. So it's really amazing that, you know, I had the opportunity, and I took the opportunity to learn it.
And now you have the opportunity to share it with so many people, which is fantastic.
Yes.
You're listening to Cascadia News Now, and that is Smakya, who is a local Lummi instructor for the Ferndale Schools. Also with me is Michael Vindiola.
I had kind of what I hope is something of a happier question. How many students do you have? How many folks are you teaching now?
So I have 3 Lummi language classes. One of them at middle school, there's like 9 students in that class. In my first year Lummi language class, I have 24 or 23, something like that. In my second year Lummi language class, I think there's about 16. There's anywhere 13 or 16. And my class that's open to the community, basically for any of the LIBC employees, you know, I offer a class from 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And so anywhere between 5 students, it could be sometimes just 1 student. Sometimes it's a large group, and there's like 15 or 20 of them.
So, Michael, you have raised a couple of children, and one of the questions that I think is, even though every culture is different and every nation is different, but something that people wrestle with is having children or younger generations get Americanized and feel reluctance to learn a language. And I think, Smakya, you said when you were young, you weren't you didn't get that it was important, or you didn't have the same feeling or passion for it.
Yes.
So how does that work? How are you working with that?
Yeah, first I wanted to say I knew it was a great idea to bring Smakya on with me so that he could say something as brilliant as he just said, which really speaks to your question of our challenge of our future generations. And my daughter is about ready to have a baby in March. I'm going to be a grandfather. And so I'm preparing myself. And when we think about, like you're asking about, the importance of why would it be important to learn about our language or learn our language when we're doing, repatriation. And that's a ceremonial question that you ask, and when we prepare ourselves to really address things in a really serious way, that's what we do. We know that that is the one of the ways that we speak to our ancestors or our relatives that passed on, our creator, however you put that, as well as preparation for our future generations. We have to be vigilant and mindful of how what we're doing now is preparing for our future generations. It's not what we're doing for ourselves. It's what we're going to be doing for our children and our children's children. So that's how I'm looking at it now. And I'm, I've only known that I'm going to be a grandpa for a few months now. And so it's really illuminated this idea of like how serious I really need to take this idea of education and the preparation. And, you mentioned the word Americanization and the fear or the, the indoctrination or whatnot of children into this, whatever this idea of Americanization is. And I think that, when we think about the work, at least that I'm doing under the Office of Native Education, it's really challenging that idea of what exactly Americanization is. And so instead of saying, well, Americanization means, Euro-American history or Euro-American language, it really means Americanization really means includes Native history and Native languages and being able to have the freedom to have that represented in your public education. And so that's the guidance that we're going off of, when we're partnering with tribes or we're thinking about how to build an educational system for tribal students in the public schools. We really think about not just those tribal students, we think about all students and how can all students really be aware of things of like what Matt was or Smakia was just talking about, because it's relatively invisible in the public schools. When you go to public school K through 12, you don't really learn about these issues where Native Americans were violated in that manner. Not that you want to be gloom and doom and ask the sad questions, but you have to have some awareness of that. You have to have, just like any community, you know about the Boston Tea Party, right? And you know that they dressed up as Native Americans when they did that. But what does that really mean? And what does cultural appropriation really look like for the Boston Tea Party and in the contemporary state like the Washington Redskins, so to speak. So there's a lot of good work to be done, and I'm really happy about it, and I'm really happy that we have modern-day warriors like Smakia who were selected, mm-hmm. by people to come forward and learn the language and be responsible for it. And so that's my main goal, is to try to pull people together and just kind of add focus to it and really think about the needs of our children and have the vision of what our elders and our ancestors laid before us, and know that that's not a gift from them, but we're borrowing it from our children, our grandchildren. So that's a really big umbrella idea of looking at it. Mm-hmm. But I really am looking at it through the lens of, reframing myself to think about how's my daughter, my granddaughter going to grow up in the society, and how do I, surround her, not necessarily protect her, but how do I surround her with all of the things that can help her make, you know, the proper decisions that would really be the values of our tribal communities. And, you know, how does she have the language? Does she know how to introduce herself? Does she know how we're all related? You know, those types of things are strong values of our tribal communities that, you know, we want to import. We want to have that represented in our public school system, you know, and it's a value for, I think, everyone could appreciate, you know, having a value like that. So we're very blessed to have some folks, you know, lawmakers and legislators and advocates, supporters in public education that have been champions of the work that, you know, I'll probably talk about, but we're fortunate to have those folks, and we're fortunate to be setting some models that are that other states are looking at, and at the national level they're looking at, you know, what we're doing, how we're doing it. So,
well, congratulations on your coming grandchild. You know, I remember those times that I have sat in Bill James's living room and his grandchildren come in, and they're weaving their hats, you know, they're weaving the Lummi traditional hats, and they will say, what does this word mean, grandfather? And he would, and he'd tell them, he'd give them the word, and then he'd ask them a question and ask them to give it back to him in the language, so that there was a real teaching environment going on in his household, which I think was, it was just great to watch. But I think one of the things that maybe a lot of listeners don't quite understand fully is that, you know, the reservations in Washington in the 1970s were not all they should have been. There were a lot of children being taken out of those environments and put into foster care. And the tribes in Washington have made great effort to try to reach out and bring those children and their grandchildren back into the tribe, and to try to bring them in and to assimilate them into a culture, because I mean, I think there was a tremendous generational trauma that occurred, and so the work that you're doing in language is vital to bringing people back and making them aware of their own culture, and then from there they become kind of ambassadors of the importance of this out into the community. I mean, you're raising a new generation of people just like yourselves who will go out and teach this language to the world.
Exactly. You know, I think that I talk to my students about, you know, boarding schools and things that our grandparents, our great-grandparents have gone through. And I talk about the importance of having Lummi language in a public school. And, you know, I tell them how lucky they are, because we will never know of all the traumas that took place in those boarding schools. But, you know, some of the stories that I have heard, you know, I can understand why, you know, this day and age, some of our children, they don't value education. You know, I always talk about it like in the sense of, if it was your grandmother that was sent to boarding school, do you think that she would stand up and say, yes, you need an education? And commonly, you know, the answer is no. I mean, straightforward, the grandparent being punished for speaking their own language, being punished for practicing their own culture, for and being forced to speak a foreign language, English. And you know, when as a child growing up and eventually having their own children, they don't have that value of education, so they don't force it onto their children. And so it continues, and it continues to the children, to the grandchildren. And somewhere along the way, we have been lucky enough that there's been a few people that actually understood the value of education. We still see that some of our students don't have that same value, and it's my job, every time I come in contact with them, to share my language, to speak with them, to share my flutes, my songs from my flute, and to kind of open up their eyes that Yes, we can practice our language, speaking our language. We can practice our culture. And it is a huge responsibility, because if I'm not there, then nobody's there. And I tell that to my students all the time, is like, how many Lummi people would actually stand up and go and teach Lummi language at Ferndale High School? I mean, I was lucky enough that, you know, my boss chose me to go there. And I couldn't say, no, I don't want to do that. That's not in our culture to do that. So, you know, that first day of walking into Ferndale High School, you know, it was kind of scary, but it was also exciting. It was scary in the sense that, you know, when I was actually attended there, you know, I always had to look down the hallway and make sure that hallways were clear before I walked. And you know, you had all these upperclassmen coming up behind you, throwing you in the garbage can and running away and laughing. And, you know, that was their sense of humor, I guess. That was their sense of fun. And so from my point of view, no, that was not fun.
So stepping back into that school brought in a lot of past and a lot of feelings.
Yes, yes. And it wasn't just the students, you know. Sometimes it was the teachers. Sometimes it was the staff members, and they would put you down for being a Lummi. And, you know, they put you in the special classes because they thought you couldn't read. And, you know, I still face that issue today, even with my son. And my son, he's in fifth grade this year, but last year we talked to his teachers, and I had to actually go back in time, and I had talked about, you know, my mom. She was a special needs person, and, you know, I was treated like I was a special needs person when I was going through school, middle school, elementary, high school. And the one thing that I told those teachers about was that we can make change. And it's going to take time. It'll take patience. But if we can figure out how my son's brain works, you know, this is how we're going to progress him and make sure that he's up to date and he can keep up with the rest of his classmates. Because if you stop and think about, you know, where I am today, you know, I've grown a lot. And if we can advance my son, you know, a little bit quicker, by the time he gets to high school, you know, he will be all set. And we don't have to have this issue of being put in special classes. But, you know, he might be, he might not be. I mean, it's really how dedicated his teachers are, how dedicated I am and my wife with you know, getting his mind up to par.
Wow, talk about working with educational system on multiple levels.
Yes.
As a father and as a teacher and as somebody who has been through it as well. And we're going to get into a little bit more about the education and the curriculum. But first, I want to remind you again that you're listening to Cascadia News Now. And our guests tonight are Smakya, who is an instructor at the Ferndale Schools and other schools of the Lummi language, and Michael Vindiola from the Office of Native Education, and he is the Native Education Director at the Office of Superintendent of Public Instruction, or OSPI. And you are listening to KMRE 102.3 FM Bellingham and 102.5 KAVZ Deming Van Zandt.
Michael, if I could ask you, I grew up in a somewhat reactionary time where there was a lot of, oh no, white history is important in my early upbringing that didn't seem unnatural to me then, but now is pretty appalling. And I'd like to hear, you know, some of what you're doing at with the Office of Superintendent of Public Instruction, what your programs are, what you're doing to bring that in.
That's a great question, and I think kind of leading into the I think you you began to introduce Matt as a professor, and I think that is such a an appropriate mistake to make, because one of the things that we're really trying to do with Indian education is to really reframe the value of traditional education or traditional values of tribal communities. And so it's not so much, you know, it does apply to state standards and the structures within public education, but it also looks at how do we include more perspective in public education. And so when we look at examples like the Maori people or the Hawaiians who are creating and restructuring education to say, well, this really is what a doctorate would be in Hawaiian culture, or a professor would be in the Hawaiian culture or language. That's our ideal goal, is to really elevate our values and our culture to be able to say, you know, to really affirm ourselves and affirm our culture and language in that manner. And so I'm very honored to work at the Office of Native Education, which is a part of the public school system under the Office of the Superintendent. And so this is an office that started in the early 70s and was a part of what is called in history self-determination for tribes. And tribes really began to push for tribal sovereignty and establishing self-governance and those types of models within their tribal communities. At the same time, the state responded to that by creating this Office of Indian Education to address, to sort of be a liaison between the public school system and the tribes. And so the idea being that this position would work with tribes to elevate the perspectives of tribal communities into the public school system. And so at that time, there was actually two directors, and the first director was Mr. Emmett Oliver, who was a Quinault tribal member, an elder. He's now passed on, but he was the first groundbreaking director of the Indian Education Office, and really put in motion a lot of things that we're still working on in terms of you know, his vision and direction. And he actually retired in the late 80s, but in 1989, the state of Washington was celebrating the centennial year of 100 years as being a state. And so at that time, Governor Booth Gardner decided to have a meeting between the tribes and the state agencies, and to bring together all of the tribal liaisons, the governor's office, and tribal leaders. And what came of that was they looked at all areas, not just education, but hunting, fishing, water, fishing rights, water rights, health care, social services, and really looking at the health and the relationship. Really, the central part of that was about relationships. What's the health of our relationships between the tribes and the state? And so one of those areas was education. And what came out of that meeting was a tremendous document called the Centennial Accord. If you want to try to understand relationships between the tribes and the state of Washington, that's the document you have to begin with. Really looked at trying to put all these things on the table that said, you know, these are areas that we need to work on and we need to focus on for the betterment of our future generations. And from there, some of the language in that document speaks to education and the need for increasing the understanding of tribal communities. And so 10 years later, in 1999, again, a meeting under Governor Gary Locke convenes the tribes and the state liaisons and the governor and talks about what's the health of our relationships. Again, what have we done in regards to the Centennial Accord to improve the relationships and improve the partnerships? And so the result of the 1999 meeting is that there's much room for improvement, and we need to really articulate what this looks like, what needs to be done. And so they create a second document called the Millennium Agreement. And from there, that's almost like a bullet list of these things need to be accomplished. And in regards to education, it speaks to, it was a great conversation. And this is all secondhand. It's not a quote or any, by any sense of the word. But I've been told about the meeting where, the state comes forward and says, well, your students aren't doing so well in our schools. You know, what can we do to help you help your students do better in our schools? And the tribal leader's response, which was a brilliant one, says, well, it's not, you can't really do anything to help our students, because the schools are not created to help our students be successful. What you could do is you could teach about our tribal communities, you could include our perspectives, and you could work to change your educational system so it's more inclusive, and so you could have teachers that our students can relate to, and you can include our history, because Native American history is Washington State history, and it precedes Washington State. What a brilliant response. And so in that 1999 Millennium Agreement, there's language that specifically says that the state should strive to teach students about tribal history, culture, and government. And it doesn't say just Native students. It says students, all students. And so that's the first time you hear that language. And at that time, also, representative at that time, John McCoy, who's a Tulalip tribal member, joins the legislature and immediately begins to work on that those two documents to address education in particular. And so from there, that's where in 2005, we see the passing of the law that says encouraging public schools to teach about tribal history, culture, and government.
It's a state law.
As a state law.
Right.
And so that, and of course that, is in the legislature, but it lands right in our office. Mm-hmm. We're responsible for interpreting and saying, so what we need, and by that time, we have Mr. Denny Hurtado, who's a Skokomish tribal member, former tribal chairman of the tribe, is now in the Office of Native Education as the director. And he says, well, we need a curriculum to match this mandate from the state, encouraging tribal history, culture, and government. And that's where he assembles a team of curriculum developers. This is just an amazing, like a lightning bolt hitting on the head of a pin or something, the head of a needle. But they assemble a team and begin to develop a curriculum on tribal sovereignty. And so that alone, conceptually, if you think about what you learn personally about tribal sovereignty in K-12, probably very limited. And so that in itself was a brilliant step forward. And then to vet that curriculum with all of the 29 tribes in the state of Washington, who all, you know, they're all their own government. It's like their own country or their own entity, is another tremendous step that Denny kind of led us through that. And then goes through the state standards. So state Common Core aligned in social studies and English. And then on top of that, this is 2005, and it's an online curriculum, all online. So it's not it doesn't have a textbook, which is one of the major issues with Indian Indian history, is that most textbooks are so horrible. So it kind of just throws that out the window. So that was a beautiful time in the development of Indian education or Native education in the state of Washington. And, I continue to work on that now as the director. 2015, as I mentioned, in 2005, it was encouraging the teaching of tribal history, culture, and government. And then the legislature looked at the implementation of that, and it said, well, that's not very satisfying. We need to have more focused attention to this issue of teaching about tribal history and culture and government. And they mandate, instead of encouraging, they now say requiring common schools to teach about tribal history, culture, and government. That happens in 2015, and then we revamp the implementation. We're now, going into the school districts and training and providing the resources needed to get the Since Time Immemorial Tribal Sovereignty in Washington State curriculum into the hands of primarily social studies teachers. But since 2015, it's just expanded tremendously. It's like, it's not only social studies, it's English, it's science, wants to utilize that curriculum. It's a new phase. It's become more dynamic than we ever imagined. And we're at a great place right now. We see, the things that Smakia was talking about really becoming, revitalized or renewed or just renew energy around it, where, Matt's been doing the work that he's been doing for many years, but now we're looking at it in a different manner. It's just like a whole, it's encapsulated in this curriculum. That language, it is a focal point of it, or is a very necessary thing to have. And so it's exciting to do that.
Wow. Well, you have an amazing responsibility, both in terms of the history and also the complexity of what it is you're doing. You kind of anticipated a question I had some time back about the multitude of tribes and the need to serve each of them as individuals and as units, tribal units. And the question that was going through my mind is, we hear a lot about the two Washingtons. It's Western Washington, Eastern Washington, but also when we're talking about that, I think we're talking about sort of affluent areas where there's good school funding, and we're talking about areas where there's difficulty funding schools. And I'm wondering if you can maybe talk about the challenges of trying to serve both of those two Washingtons in your role.
Yeah, there certainly is a lot of challenges. And, one of the things is that even though it is mandated now, there's not a lot of consequence to it. So if you don't adopt, like the law says that anytime you renew your social studies curriculum is when you would implement the Since Time Immemorial. And so we're doing our best to kind of keep track of when districts are doing that.
Can you just explain Since Time Immemorial? Because I think it's the first time we brought it up as a term.
So that's the formal name of our tribal sovereignty curriculum. Is called Since Time Immemorial Tribal Sovereignty in Washington State. And that's the curriculum that was developed by our curriculum team and then was then vetted by the tribes in Washington State and Common Core aligned and utilized in the public schools. And one of the challenges is that there's not a lot of teeth. There's not like funding that will be withheld if a district doesn't properly implement. And so, and we don't really want to be in that position. We want folks who are really genuinely interested in converting in education to a more progressive, you know, realm. But another challenge is, as you mentioning, you know, there's inequity in resources in different districts. Essentially, right now, we're in the realm of working with the districts that do want to work with the curriculum. We're not at a, I mean, if we had a huge staff, which we don't, so if there's any listeners out there that want to make a contribution to the Office of Native Education, we'd love additional staff. But, you know, we have a list of folks who are stepping forward to implement the curriculum. One of the challenges is the is in the new law, it's requiring the curriculum be implemented, but the second part of it is the partnerships with the tribes. And so what we revealed in the last 3 years is that partnership is still a challenge between a school district and the local tribe. And so when we're trying to implement this curriculum, it's kind of pushing that envelope, saying the second part of this law is it requires that you work with the local tribe as a partner in the development of this curriculum. And the reason why it's that way is because the state and our curriculum team, it would have been a horrible, miserable failure if we tried to say, well, this is what Lummi history is, mm-hmm. and this is what Colville history is, and we tried to say that ourselves. It would have not gone. We would not have gotten the tribal support we needed. So now the challenge is, how do we get these two districts together? How do we get Colville and OMAC School District to talk to each other and support this initiative, and really utilize things like tribal consultation? And tribal, you know, if you say tribal consultation in some circles, they'll be like, you know, you're the bad guy. You know, what the heck are you bringing that word up for, those words up for? Because tribal consultation has had such a bad outcome for tribes.
Can you just tell us a little bit, give us a little backstory?
So like, a short backstory is like a federal tribal consultation is held with the tribe for land that that a railroad needs to go through, or they want to do Black Hills gold. They want to get resources from it. Well, a tribal consultation to some tribes means you come in and you just tell us what you're going to do, and then you go ahead and do it without whether we agree with you or not. So that, in some circles, is what tribal consultation means. So that's a real challenge for us. You know, I've really strived to focus on consent more than tribal consultation, that a tribe is actually saying, we actually want to work with you on this tribal sovereignty curriculum. Because the reality of it is this is a state law that was passed by a state, and tribes have no obligation to uphold it. Their agreement as a treaty tribe is with the federal government. So they really don't have to deal with us, you know. And so there's a lot of levels, I would say, to this game and to, you know, making this happen. But I think, you know, in response to your question, that's the real challenge, is how do we, at the local level, build these partnerships? And so that's been our goal, is to really, you know, as a tribe comes, you know, we're playing with, you know, multiple partners and stakeholders. So if a tribe says, well, we're not really seeing our district implement this since time immemorial curriculum, you know, how can you help us? Then I know that they're at least interested in seeing that happen. And then I get a hold of the school district. But then if a school district is saying, well, we're really interested in implementing the curriculum, but we have a hard time connecting with the tribe, then I go to to that tribe and try to build the relationship, build, you know, do the relationship building and get everybody in the same room and, you know, begin the partnership. So
does it matter if a tribe is not federally recognized? Because I know we have a lot of federally recognized tribes in Washington State, but some that aren't. Right. But since you're working with the state, does that
right.
make a
that,
difference?
It is a, it's an issue, you know, and there's at least seven that are, that have, you know, prominently been identified. And, you know, the we... me as the director of the Office of Native Education as a state entity can only go off of what the interpretation of that law is, which it says working with federally recognized tribes, the 29 federally recognized tribes. So, but that does not mean we, you know, it doesn't say you can only work with. And so when we do consultations in Seattle, I mean, not consultations, trainings in Seattle, for example, you know, we talk about, you know, who we know at Duwamish, you know, and we say, you know, they could be a partner with you if you want to reach out to them. So that's our way of, you know, addressing that issue. You know, we try to be as open as possible with perspectives. And so we know that those tribes are out there, you know, devastating, you know, that's not even a, you know, that's like a 1950s, that's not even really that long ago where termination happened in 40s, whatever, and, you know, these tribes are regaining their recognition in the 40s and 50s. So, you know, I imagine that these tribes will have the recognition sometime in the future. And so it would be best to continue to partner with them.
You know, many years ago in a different life, I lived in Tucson, Arizona, and my neighbor was a linguist at the University of Arizona, and he was trying to put together a grammar of the Apache language, and it was a race against time for him because, people that were masters of the language were getting older and they were dying and it needed to be done. And I wonder if you can speak to the urgency of trying to capture the languages of these Washington tribes while they're still live languages. And I guess by live languages, I mean you can do crossword puzzles and, right. and tell puns and it's a complete and full language in its own right.
And have cross-generational conversations.
Right. Correct. Maybe. Absolutely
well,
correct.
I'm going to turn it over to Smakia, but I will say that that's a priority for our office is to support whatever efforts you know, folks like Smakia are doing. So if they say, well, we want an immersion school for our early learning, you know, kids, then that's what I'm going to go after for them. And we're doing that, you know, like we're trying to do that at the Kalispell. And as you can see, I'm sure all of our listeners cannot see that I'm pointing towards Kalispell, but I like to situate myself.
Orient your radio. Turn it in the direction you mean.
You know, Kalispell Tribe is doing a halftime immersion school with Usk School District.
Wow.
And so in the morning, they go to the Usk School District. And at lunchtime, after lunch, they walk over to the tribally owned immersion school for the Kalispell tribe. And so we're, you know, and we see that. There's issues. There's all kinds of issues with that. But for me, I need to figure it out. I need to figure out those issues and resolve them. Not tell Kalispell or not tell Usk that you can't do that. But we need to be flexible. And that's the kind of going back to the historical and the Americanization of our tribal students and our and all students is really reframing and rethinking the way that we look at education and how flexible it needs to be. But you know, I'd love to hear what Smakia has to say in regards to you know, how that regeneration can happen or urgency.
So definitely, you know, when our languages are dying, there is that sense of urgency. And in the late 60s and the early 70s, we had a linguist come through and study our language. We had actually three or four different linguists that came through and studied. And one of them decided to focus on just one elder, and that became the basis of what we're teaching today. And, you know, we have, I don't know how many hundreds of hours of recordings, but we were lucky enough to work with that linguist. He gave us the recordings, he gave us the notebooks, and, you know, writing in the IPA, I was able to actually look at it and understand it, transcribe it, translate it, and, you know, use it in classroom today. And so it is a lot of work. It's a lot of brain work, and it is a little bit of a training. But, you know, in the long run, when you think about what we're doing to try and save our language, you know, it's the most important thing that we can do for ourselves. Our language identifies who we are as a people. It doesn't matter what tribe you are. You have a native language. You need to speak it. You need to learn it.
And one of the things that you said in the first half of the show, Smekya, that really struck home with me was when you were talking about how teaching and learning and sort of living in the language affects your mood and how you think. And it's something that I don't think we think about a lot, but it's not just a different word for bird. Like, it's a whole different way of being that people don't understand. And then you were talking about when you have one sentence or a couple of words that can mean so many different things. And I was thinking about how white people talk fast and talk a lot, because we have so many words for different things that we're just throwing them around.
Yeah, definitely.
So we have just about five, actually only just a couple minutes left, and I'm going to throw the last question to you, Tim.
Oh, what's next? I mean, what is the Michael, you did a wonderful job of talking about the past. What's the future? And if you can, the funding of schools is always a question. Great. I know you can't talk about that too much, but if our schools are fully funded, what does the future look like?
Oh, gosh. Well, for our office, what we're working on, one of our newest initiatives passing in 2013 is our state tribal education compact schools. It's a compact. It's an agreement between the state of Washington and any of the 29 tribes, federally recognized tribes in the state. Actually, I take that back. It's not only the 29 federally recognized tribes, but also BIE schools. And so, at any rate, the intention is that it's a state-funded, tribally operated school that would really focus on some of the things that I was talking about, like the Kalispell Language Immersion School. So we're really, like, really... Again, you know, not to sound like a broken record, but really trying to reframe the education values of that we're offering tribal students. So,
and I'm so sorry because it's hard to wrap up because right. I want to talk to you for another few hours, and maybe you'll come back, or maybe
we will.
Okay,
we'll stick around right now.
Oh, that's great. That was Michael Vindiola. He's the director of the Office of Native Education at the Office of Superintendent of Public Instruction for Washington State. Also with us, Smekya, who I'm now going to call a professor of Lemmy Language at the Ferndale School. So I've been wanting to say that for the entire show. And Tim Johnson, Dave Willingham, and I'm Stephanie Contours. And thanks to Devlin Sweeney, who is our fabulous engineer. This is KAVZ 102.5 in Deming, Van Zandt, and KMRE 102.3 FM in Bellingham.